direct from the web, it's Billy Masters Live. And now, please welcome your host, Billy Masters.
Oh my God, we're back. We're back. Welcome to Billy Masters Live. So where were we? Now, you know what's really funny is I was in Fort Lauderdale last week, and somebody came up to me in a supermarket, in a Publix supermarket, Publix, the X, near the Galleria. And somebody said to me, this guy came up to me and said, aren't you Billy Masters? And I said, yes. And he said, you know, I've really missed your show the last 6 weeks. And I went, well, I'm still doing them. Isn't the camera on? And of course, I haven't been doing any shows. And I've missed you all, I must say. After 75 shows in quarantine, you kind of get used to having company twice a week. Oh, I should say thank you, Monica. Today is Thursday, February 11th, for the archivists out there keeping track of these things. First off, can I just say thank you to all the fans? Because our year-end show, and staggering, really, to even think about it, our year-end show, which was the week between Christmas and New Year's, has been seen by almost 20,000 of you. The last numbers I saw were like 19,200, like crazy. And when we started this, when the pandemic began it's almost a year now. I was just telling Melissa backstage, it was right after my surgery. And if you look at those old shows, I'm wearing a sling and people could only see this band across me. And somebody had asked, are you wearing a seatbelt? And I'm like, no, it's actually a sling. But anyway, when we started this, you know, we got a few dozen people and it was just for me and my friends to sit and talk. And 75 shows later, close to 20,000 of you tuning in. And I have to thank the guests because these people are also, you know, it's funny. I keep thanking guests, but the guests have said to me, thank you, because it's given them something to do and a way to interact with the fans. So I think, you know, this whole thing is very synergistic in that we all really are getting something out of it for ourselves and giving something to others. And I think if there's some silver lining to this ridiculous pandemic, it's that maybe in a way, in being alone, we have connected more with each other. Who knows? I mean, it's far too philosophical and touchy-feely for me to get into at this ungodly hour of 3 p.m. My God, I would barely be awake. Anyway, I was in Florida last week, which is why I'm a little tanned and a little bit blonder. But I am telling you all, continue, wear your masks, stay away from people. Trust me, if the person in the supermarket hadn't been a fan, I went to talk to them. People on the street, I didn't see a mask in South Florida on the street anywhere. And there was this big report in Northern Florida the week just before the Super Bowl that in this supermarket, there was this anti-mask guy who runs the supermarket who would not let any of his employees wear masks. You know, I know it's tough and I know you all need jobs. And God knows none of us have money coming in. But if you are working someplace, particularly with the public, and you can't wear a mask, quit. I mean, you know, I'm not going to send you money, but quit because your health is more important. All right, fine. That's it. Just a few notes. Next week on Tuesday, we will be doing a tribute show to Mary Wilson of the Supremes. We were going to do something this past Tuesday, and I really didn't want to throw it together. And we have some of her friends that will be joining us, some very famous people who have been friends to this show. I don't want to say names because, you know, but there may be some pointers here. There may be some loves here. There could be some pains here. That's all I'm going to say. And also people who worked with her behind the scenes. There's new music coming out of Mary. Just, you know, the Supremes were such a huge part of my life. And it was, You know, it is like a part of me died. It's like Melissa Manchester today. It's really the tapestry of many of our lives. So anyway, Mary will be here next Tuesday. Next Thursday, actor Eric Roberts is going to be here. And I'm just so excited about that because I've been a fan of his for so many years. So, I mean, we've got really great shows. We've got so many people coming up. And with 6 weeks off, people just came out of the woodwork and were saying to me, well, when are you back? Because we want to come on. So I'm thrilled that we'll be here. I don't know if we will be doing Tuesday shows. Right now we are. But I've got another project that I've been working on, which is why, so Melissa knows this. Melissa was supposed to be on originally this Tuesday. We were going to start the show on a Tuesday because, you know, beginning of the week. And I wasn't sure if I was going to be available. I had to move some things around. And then by the time I had moved things around, she'd moved things around. So that's why we're here on Thursday. So for now, we will be on Tuesdays, but we may have to go down to once a week or maybe find another time. But I know that you guys are going to follow me no matter what, and I appreciate that. Okay. This is the most ridiculous story in the world. When I moved from Boston to Los Angeles in August of 1997, I scheduled my move around Melissa Manchester. And she's looking at me like I'm crazy. On August 10th, she was playing in Las Vegas. And I had friends that were going to be in Las Vegas, and they said, oh, you know, if you move to L.A., you know, you'll be able to come out here. And I wasn't going to be able to get to L.A. into my apartment earlier. And I said, I can't go to Las Vegas. And then they told me like 5 shows they were going to see, like they were going to see Cher and Siegfried and Roy and that guy with the puppets. And then he said, and Melissa Manchester. I said, I'll fly in for Melissa Manchester, and I'll sleep like on the streets if I have to, because Melissa Manchester is one of those rare people. There's a lot of singer-songwriters out there, and we're going to talk about that. There's a lot of songwriters. There's a lot of singers. There's a lot of singer-songwriters. There are very few people who are able to make someone else's song their own and so personal that it touches you. And I'm going to If this were like the old CD days and my house were on fire and I had to pick 5 CDs to walk out of the house with, and you know how important music is to me, and I hate to play favorites, Tribute by Melissa Manchester would be one of the first CDs I would take. From beginning to end, it is a magnificent collection. And I hate to even say that CD because she didn't write any of it, but it is something so special to me. And this performer I have adored for years, and I've been privileged to meet her several times, but never talked to her like this. So please welcome Melissa Manchester.
Hello.
Hello, thank Melissa.
Thank you for having me.
It's so funny because I remember meeting you several times, and I had seen you years and years ago with the Boston Pops, mm-hmm. And John Williams, mm-hmm. and you were sitting at the piano for some of it, you were standing for some of it, and yes. That can be very awkward for people to make the transition from, you know, playing for themselves to then just standing there. They don't know what to do with their hands, or they can't connect with people, and no matter what you were doing, whether you had a symphony behind you, a piano in front of you, or just a microphone in front of you, you still managed to connect with every single person in the audience. And that's a special gift.
Thank you. Well, thank you very much. But, I was raised in a house full of music where listening to great singers who had great songwriters write for them, That was not the age of the singer-songwriter. That's what I grew up with. And when the singer-songwriter started to emerge and it really struck me and I knew that that's what I wanted to do, I already had that foundation of knowing what Ella sounded like and Judy sounded like and all of those great singers who I pay tribute to on the tribute album, mm-hmm. That you were kind enough to cite. And so the delivering and owning of a great composition has as much weight to it as delivering and owning a song that I've written, because I understand the gravitas of both.
But how do you make something that someone else wrote as personal as you do? Do you really delve into it? Because you also act. And I think that people who are actors can really tell a story in a way that somebody who is, I don't want to say just a singer, but just a singer can't.
Right. Well, you know, if a song is a great composition, like Don't Cry Out Loud, the lyrics give you so much to not only sing, the melody certainly gives you so much to sing, but the lyrics give you so much to invest emotionally into. And the reason I love singing my songs, my hits over the years, and have never tired of them, is because they've become these monologues that the more I live, the more I can invest in these living vehicles.
Are there songs that have, that over time have gained gravitas for you because of your life experience?
Yes, most of them.
Really?
Know, most of them have, yes, because, you know, for the ones that I've written, I remember the moment, the conversation that the song came out of. And the songs that I didn't write, I remember the moment that they were given to me as, you know, presented as gifts. And, you know, for instance, a song like Through the Eyes of Love, mm-hmm. Well, Marvin Hamlisch and Carol Sager were friends of mine. And so they called up one afternoon and they said, we wrote this song for a movie. Would you like to sing it? We'd love you to sing it. So it was, you know, it was an afternoon in the studio. You have no idea what the result will be and how it will touch people and how it will become the wedding song for decades, decades, you know? So it's all kind of remarkable. You know, it's the same with writing. You're, mm-hmm. you're sitting in front of a piano in front of a blank piece of paper and you don't know, you have no idea what will come back to you once you offer it out into the universe.
You know, people who watch the show know, but, you know, excuse me, fans, for repeating myself, but to tell your story, I have to tell a little bit of my story, is that I started as a pianist at four, and like you, wasn't initially able to read music, but was able to play by ear.
Correct.
And so, you know, I hear a jingle, and it was a jingle. It was a Budweiser commercial. I remember vividly. It's when you say Bud, you've said it all. Mm-hmm. And again, because the notes were next to each other, it was very easy to plunk out.
Yes.
But everyone's like, oh my God, he's a prodigy. Over the years, sometimes playing by ear can work against you as somebody who, I was a classical pianist, because it's much more rigid, especially when you're starting. It sounded like you were always able to kind of improvise and bring yourself to your music, even at a young age.
Yeah, I mean, I studied piano, and my ear was much quicker than my eye-hand coordination. You know, I would improvise Chopin. And so my teachers would ask me, where are you on the page? And I would say, I have no idea. It just sounds really good to me. And so when I found songwriting and I could, you know, I could take whatever chops I had learned from playing piano and use them, it became extremely useful. But what I also learned in time was that the body has sense memory.
Yep.
So if you sit at the piano to write, frequently your hands will start to go to the same chord patterns. Mm-hmm. And so I learned to not create melodies at the piano, but to just walk around or take a walk and hear them and create the grooves in my brain first and then find the harmonics to accompany it.
Right. And I think that that also explains why you have a particular sound that is, no matter what, whether it's of the electronica music or the studio mm-hmm. music or just the solo piano music, you can pick out a Melissa Manchester song.
Oh, thank you. Thanks.
Did you, you know, speaking of the electronica, it seemed to me, and the pop music, mm-hmm. it seemed to me that that was it came out, it was very hard, I think, for a lot of singer-songwriters to make that transition, and yet your songs still sounded like your songs.
Well, you know, I started in the early 70s as a singer-songwriter for mm-hmm. with that as part of that sort of second wave of singer-songwriters. And when the early 80s showed up, disco was in full throttle. And because I was in the music business, the business of music, you know, the heads of the record company wanted me to become current. And right. current was never anything I was terribly interested in. But I was a good sport, and I tried to play along, and I did. And so I would, you know, so my friends, Dean Pitchford and Tom Snow presented, You Should Hear How She Talks About You to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my feeling is if a composition is solid enough and there's something I can wrap my head around and my voice around and my brain around, then I can walk the walk of the song, even if mm-hmm. the world of the sound isn't particularly interesting to me. But I had the great opportunity to have that record produced by the great Arif Mardin, who was yeah. one of the great producers of all times. And so that was that. And the success of that was really remarkable. But then when I went into the studio to make the Mathematics album, which funnily enough, my students really like that album. They really like it. And the thing was, at that point, because of disco and electronics, no longer was the focus really on the artist. The focus was then really on the production and the producers and all of the new electronic toys that people could play with. Right. And I lost my way. But because I had committed to this adventure, I showed up, I would sing. I really carried myself as the girl singer, because I couldn't hang out in the studio because the sounds of the tracks were not terribly interesting to me. I couldn't cozy it. Nothing was cozy.
You know, everything and was you didn't have collaborators with you in the studio in that time. A lot of that, well, you were solo, which is very difficult, I would
yeah,
think, for you.
Yeah, I mean, you know, some of the songs I wrote, co-wrote, and some of the songs, if you stripped all the electronics and just played it on a piano or a guitar, they'd be solid compositions. But mm-hmm. The thing is, you know, as an artist, you live in chapters, you try different things, and you see if you can grow and by trying stuff, and I did.
Well, and not only that, I think it's a challenge. And I think as somebody yeah. who's a musician, I know people who want to keep doing the same thing because they yes. do it very well.
Yes.
And then there are people who, you know, and I also have ADD as well. So I will get bored with something and I need to try something that's going to challenge me.
Well, as they say in the record industry, the only thing harder than the first single is the second single.
Well, and you've also said many times, every performance is an audition.
Yes, yes. The audition is never over. That is true.
I want to talk, since you brought up You Should Hear, you re-recorded it this past, I guess just a couple months ago, although the video was just edited like a couple weeks ago.
Yes.
You know, what I think, I'm going to show a clip of the video, but what I think is so interesting is, I never thought of the song in this context. And I think that's, again, one of the things of a great, not even necessarily a great composition, but a great interpreter, is that they can make something relevant in a completely different way.
Well, this project that I'm unfolding each month mm-hmm. since September is called Review. Mm-hmm. And it is the re-recording of several of my hits, mostly as is, and sometimes some have harmonic tweaks, but there are no fades. There's not one fade on any of the tracks. I cut out fades from my life, because on stage, you don't fade. You end the
right.
performance, and I find that much more interesting and thrilling. But when I, and so because we're in this pandemic and nobody can go anywhere, I felt, A, it was time to do this, and roll them out one at a time, one per month, with mm-hmm. a video. And on the practical level, the reason that I'm doing it, and by the way, so are many of my artist colleagues, is because when we first recorded these, our songs in the early 70s and up to the mid 80s, our record companies were basically the bank. Right. And so we were locked in and they owned the masters. And right. The social media didn't exist. Revenue streams didn't exist. It was just the record and that was it. And so what many of my colleagues and I are doing in this moment are re-recording our hits so that we can be contacted directly to license these songs and have revenue streams. Anyway, but the point that you were attending to earlier, I found, not by design, but so many of these songs have grown into this moment. We first released Just You and I, and the video that I envisioned was to pay homage to all of the frontline workers that mm-hmm. were taking care of us during the pandemic and putting their lives on the line. And so that was that. And I did Midnight Blue, which was an actual conversation between present me singing it and younger me singing it through vintage videos. And Don't Cry Out Loud, I did in tribute to all of us performers who can't work and how many venues have been shut down because of the pandemic. So interesting.
Oh, and actually, let me just stop about that for a second. Is that what, and we have that video as well. Sure. What's really interesting about Don't Cry Out Loud is that I have a dear friend that I went to high school with whose daughter is planning on getting married in April or May.
Yes.
And we had just had this conversation last week about what do you do? And she said, and a lot of people have canceled weddings. And right. her daughter has decided it's not about the party. It's not about the big celebration. It's about us getting married. So we can get married. We can celebrate some other time. And I have a niece who graduated high school in June who had no celebration. All of a sudden, I'm looking at your video and it's a progression. Yeah. It starts with, this has happened, what are we going to do? Then right. we can't do this, then we can't do this. And what I realized is that the video came out around the holidays and it's a cautionary tale.
It is.
Don't cry out loud, but also don't risk a big celebration yes. because that's not what it's about.
Yes, that's true. That is very true. I mean, I've had that experience with myself, with my kids. My daughter received her MBA during the pandemic. We were going to have a great big celebration. We had a very modest one. My son was supposed to get married last May. They postponed it till this coming May, God willing. And my right. daughter-in-law-to-be, who's magnificent, she said, we're getting married. There may be three people there. We are getting married.
So- right. And I think it also has made the younger people sort of see their lives a little bit differently that maybe will behoove them well in the future. I mean,
well,
I hope.
Yes, I was watching something on the news about dating in the time of COVID.
Ugh.
And well, the interesting thing is it has slowed the getting to know you part way down. So people are now back engaged, like in Victorian times, in getting to know each other, speaking over Zoom, talking, literally getting to know each other and just slowing the whole process down. It's really great. Really interesting.
I'm going to just show a clip from Don't Cry Out Loud, and then I also have another question about it.
Sure.
Let's just show this little clip.
Of course. Don't cry out loud. Just keep it inside. Learn how to hide your feelings. Fly high and proud. And if you should fall,
what I love about that is It starts very soft, and I've seen interviews with you where you talk about how you've always wanted the song to be more of a lullaby and a reflection and a lesson to share with somebody, and not the big belty song that it became. So you've kind of combined both ideas into this new version.
Well, yes. I mean, when I first heard Peter Allen's interpretation of his beautiful song, that he wrote with Carol Sager, it was a very quiet performance. And I thought, oh my God, this is the lullaby to end all lullabies. And then in those days, I don't recall being informed of the arrangement that I would be singing to. And so I walked into the studio and there was a room full of musicians and there was this anthemic interpretation, and it freaked me out. And the performance that you hear on the original record is one of real rage and frustration. And it worked for the interpretation of the song. But what I've, and it took me a while to understand what the lyric was about, because Carol's lyric is so beautifully dense. That it has lots of meat to gnaw on in terms of investigating how to perform it. And I learned, and because Carol Sager and I always wrote songs about self-affirmation and raising your voice and claiming your voice and claiming your life, and suddenly I'm having big success with this song where the first word of the chorus is don't. Yeah. I mean, it took me a while to understand why people were connecting with it. And it took me an even longer period of time to understand that the truth of the song that people get is that bottom line, it's a song about what we must all learn how to do, which is to cope. Mm-hmm. And so once I got that locked in, I could get on top of the song and lead the charge because I understood what I was singing. But in this latest interpretation, I really do pay homage to the original. But I just think that with these videos, to underscore something that is happening in this moment, my hope is that when I'm finished with all of these 10 or 12 tracks, which I'm still working on, and review is released as a CD or whatever, as a whole project, the videos will show a journal of this moment in time, which, God willing, we will never go through again, but you never know. That's my feeling.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the universality, because again, it hadn't occurred to me with the lyrics, and I usually connect so much with lyrics, but when I saw the video, I saw that, you know, I've always considered the song you sharing a message with either a child or with a friend or whatever. Mm-hmm. But I really got the universality is that we're all in this together. We all have something to cry about.
Yes.
And yeah, we get it. You're all upset. But instead of crying out loud, deal with it.
Right. And know that you are not alone in this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And again, the visuals are so beautiful. Who did the video?
Paco Sanchez did the video, and he's been doing all of my videos lately, and he's wonderfully talented and accommodating for my ideas, and his ideas are just wonderful as well.
Yeah, it's beautifully done, and I urge people to look for it online. You know, what is the difference? You know, there are so many singer-songwriters now. We are in a time where everybody is writing their own material. And I've often believed, and I'm sorry to say this to somebody who may be listening, just because you think you can write a song doesn't mean you can write a song.
That is true.
And you came from a time, and you mentioned it earlier, where you straddled the period of great song interpreters.
Yes.
The Tony Bennetts, the Mel Tormes, the Judy Garlands, who didn't necessarily write their songs and it didn't matter. They were able to personalize it. And then the Paul Simons and, you know, Barbara Streisand and Paul Williams and people like that, James Taylor, Carole King, who really were known as interpreters of their own work. Mm-hmm. And do you think that today's people, they have to write their own work, or is it okay to go in search of maybe this hidden gem that nobody knows?
Well, I think, I you know, you raised a lot of points with those earlier singers, Ella and Judy and Tony. They were also not only singing songs that were written for them, they were also singing many Broadway show tunes that became pop hits. That doesn't exist anymore. And as far as writers for today, here's the bottom line. You can make a lot of money if your name is one of the writers, whether you wrote one line or whether you were actually in the room. And, you know, and everybody knows that, and management knows that. And sometimes people truly are creative, and sometimes they're just nice. and it's all, you know, it's all fine. Everybody's realized that there are many more slices to the pie. The slices have become smaller and smaller and smaller. So I don't know that it's absolutely necessary to be your own songwriting person. I think everybody's always looking for that great song vehicle to break open a career.
Is there a genre that you haven't tackled that you wanted to? You know, I remember when Linda Ronstadt started doing, say, the standards, and then she was doing Pirates of Penzance, and then she was doing the Mexican songs that her father had sung. And people were really disturbed by, oh, now she's this. Now she's a ballad singer. Now she's it. And I'm like, she could do anything. And I put you in that category. Is there something you'd like to tackle that you haven't done yet?
Well, first of all, I'm thrilled that when you cited Tribute, which I made in 1989, which was my tribute to the great women singers that meant so much to me, I'd always wanted to complete the idea with a tribute to all the fellas. And so I made the fellas a couple of years ago. So I did that, and that was not easy to get made because it was not terribly interesting as a vehicle to record companies, but now
really,
no. But now that I'm truly an independent artist, which means it's my record company and I'm the executive producer. And I learned all about that, by the way, through my teaching.
We're going to get to that.
Yeah. My students taught me about being an independent artist, and you know, it's really, really interesting. But to answer your question, yeah, there's all sorts of music, I suppose. I wrote a choral piece. All of this stuff, by the way, you can find on my Facebook page.
And on YouTube, there's a lot
right,
there
and
on your
YouTube,
page.
Right, exactly. And I wrote a choral piece called Awake, which I released earlier last year. And I'm just finishing the second choral piece. So it will end up being a suite. So, you know, who knows why the heart is attracted to whatever it's attracted to? You know, it's the same impulse. It's always the idea that is so compelling that it's all you think about until you wrestle it to the ground or until you surrender to it, you know. So, there's a theater project that I'm just starting to work on now. And so it's just an interesting time. One of the things that I, you know, when we first started with the pandemic, I don't know if you had this experience, but my career was brought to a slam halt. And I had to get through the anxiety of what to do next and the grief of what I had lost and not knowing what was coming next. And now, you know, I just do this day by day. And there have been many blessings, and the particular blessing is to have the time to think, not be on a plane going somewhere where thought is just sort of, you know, out of the corner of your eye, but to actually have the time to muse on what you think you're up to next. It's been interesting. I think it's been useful and an unexpected gift as far as I'm concerned.
Has it been a time that has inspired you in terms of your writing?
Yes, it has. As I said, I worked on this choral piece because I have the time to work on this choral piece. And, you know, when you're working on a choral piece, it's soprano, alto, tenor, bass, and the piano parts. And I'm not used to writing that way. I'm used to writing, you know, just a chord symbol and off we go into the next lyric. But to actually have to slow my brain down and say, how is the best way to write this? Who could sing? You know, it's very interesting. And I've been studying Spanish. I don't
really
know how to speak Spanish, but every day I study it a little bit.
You mentioned Tribute. One last question about it. You said that getting the fellas made was hard. Was Tribute a hard sell? And it was such a huge hit.
Yeah, it was. These albums were such beautiful projects because they were pure in their intent. I just wanted to say thank you to these women and these men who were my, you know, psychic musical godmothers and godfathers. Mm-hmm. And you know, in 1989, it was really kind of, you want to do what? You want to do a funny song? But I got a chance to work with the great Peter Matz, the arranger who had worked with everybody, including Barbra Streisand in her early years. The way I got the fellas done many years later is that I'm artist in residence at a lovely community college out here called Citrus College, which has a spectacular music department. And the dean of the music department came to me one day and he said, can you think of a project you'd like to do with our music students? And I thought, funny you should ask. And that's how the fellas came to be. Their big band, which is who you hear playing on the album, is made up of students and alum and professors. And these kids are trained magnificently. And the arrangements are just stunning.
That's what I was just going to say. The arrangements are what grabbed me on that. Because, you know, when you do covers, there is an idea that you have to be really faithful to the original.
Absolutely.
And then there's an idea that you have to go completely the opposite way and make it your own. So it seems to me to be quite a balancing act.
Well, I thought, you know, to make it your own while paying tribute to the style of the original recordings, you know, hard swing. I mean, who plays that anymore? And to have kids, you know, to have students learning these feelings, which is not their genres at all. It was really a fantastic experience because they could feel the power of the music and they could feel that they were in the deep end of an adventure that they wouldn't otherwise be in. So it was really great.
You know, you would think that given the success of something like Tribute, that then you'd be able to say, look, I did so well with the women. Let's do the men. And, no, you know, it doesn't work that way.
No, it doesn't work that way. Again, context being everything, that was 1989. Mm-hmm. And you forget what life was like for women artists back then. It was just complicated.
Right. You know, you've talked about working with lots of people. We mentioned very briefly Paul Simon. You actually studied with Paul Simon.
I did. He was my songwriting teacher. I studied songwriting with him for 6 months, and it was exceptional learning from him because at the time, Bridge Over Troubled Waters was number one all over the world.
Wow.
And he had 6 months off, and he felt like teaching, and he auditioned all of us. And at the time, he brought me into the room, and at the time, Laura Nero, who is not a name most people know anymore, she was really my muse. And so he had me play a song, and he said, play another song. And I played another song, and he said, just play me one more song. And I played him a third song, and he said, do you listen to Laura Nero? I said, all the time, every day. He said, it's time to stop. And his, you know, what he taught me, I teach to my students, which is about the fact that all stories have been told in songwriting. It is the way you tell your story that separates you out. It's the way you use language. It's the way you twist harmonics that makes your creations interesting. And it was spectacular.
You've collaborated with a lot of people, and you've mentioned Carol Bayer-Sager, Barry Manilow.
Yes.
How did Barry come into your life?
Barry and I, Manilow and I, were both jingle singers, and we had met during several jingle sessions that we were singing on. And I was, a burgeoning club performer, and he had just become the new musical director for Bette Midler. Mm-hmm. And it turned out that they were performing at a club called the Continental Bathhouse down the street from a club I was performing at in called The Focus. And he brought Bette to see me one night at the club. And it was just great. And out of that came the Harlettes. And I was a founding member of the Harlettes, and I was the toots in the middle.
And we've had, I don't know, are you the fourth Harlette we've had? We've had Charlotte, Jennifer, Linda. So at some point we're going to do a Harlette show with all of you, with Barry, with Mark.
Yes, and Charlotte took over for me,
and you actually taught her all of the parts.
Yes, that's right. But it was incredible working with Bette. She's a brilliant woman, and working with Barry was so stunning, and that he has remained such a lovely friend throughout the decades is just unbelievable. And when he sang the duet on The Fellas, the only duet, it was just incredible. It was incredible generosity of his spirit. It's beautiful.
There's also a great thing that you do in your live concerts, which is you sing with him virtually.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Which is fabulous. I've seen you do that.
Yes.
And we should just remind people, there you are in the day. My God, in merciful heaven.
Yes.
And of course, more recently.
Yes. Uh-huh.
But what I love is this photo.
Oh, yes. Yes,
I think it's such a great picture.
Yes. Well, you know, you wouldn't know, but the night after Bette won the Tony Award for Hello, mm-hmm. Dolly, she received it at Radio City Music Hall. Mm-hmm. And I sent her an email and I said, congratulations on this stunningly well-deserved award. I said, however, I don't know if you remember, but the first time you ever went to Radio City, I took you.
Really?
And we went with my late mother and my sister, and it was so wonderful to see after all these decades that you accept an award from that stage. And she wrote me right back, and it was very sweet.
What did you see at Radio City with her? Do you remember?
Boy, that's a good question. I don't remember. I'll have to think of that.
You know, it's interesting you mention about doing research and doing your homework and really understanding what came before you. And one of the things I know about Bette, which I admire a great deal, when she was preparing for Hello, Dolly, she actively sought out everybody's interpretation. She wanted to see everything that was done, flew to Palm Springs to sit with Carol Channing, and then took what worked for her and then made it her own. And I know you are a huge researcher as well.
Well, I am, yes. You know, when I was singing for Tribute and The Fellas, you know, you choose these artists and you choose the song that you feel will capture the central core of their career. And you listen to how they breathed and how long the lines were and where their heart was and where the emphasis was. And then you find your own way into it, mm-hmm. you know, because you must.
And I think if you don't know what worked and what didn't for somebody else, you're at a huge disadvantage because now you're fumbling around in the dark. Although still could find something yourself,
absolutely. And you know, it's really interesting because sometimes people will say, well, how do you feel when other people sing your song? Well, I feel fantastic when other people sing my song because I grew up in those times where many singers would cut the same song because the song had value. It was great, you know. So yeah, it's fantastic.
Has somebody done one of your songs that they did something that you thought, that is something that never occurred to me and something I could use?
I had the great honor to write a song for Barbara Streisand that she sang at her wedding. and recorded on an album called A Love Like Ours, which was dedicated to her husband-to-be at the time, James Brolin. And it was a song called Just One Lifetime, and I had recorded it, and it was sent to her because of this upcoming album. And the note that came back to me was, I love the choruses, but I can't really cozy up to the verses. Would you consider rewriting it? And I thought, well, yes. Then I went back to my collaborator, Tom Snow, and I said, this is what's happening. And I said, so if you're okay with it, let's deconstruct the verses, complete music and lyrics. Mm. And let me do some research about what Barbara is up to that has made her surrender to this beautiful love, to be ready for this beautiful love, to, you know, because she had had boyfriends and a failed marriage. And she
right. It's a different time of her life.
It was a very, exactly right, very, very different and deeper and more spiritual time of her life. She was really leaning into those things. And I incorporated as much of those elements into the lyrics of that song. And when she did it, I remember taking the CD and I brought my late mother to my car because, you know, car sound systems are great. I said, mm-hmm. I said to her, I'm not going to tell you what this is or who's singing it, but I will tell you that I wrote this. And I turned it on and it was Streisand, and she was looking out the passenger side window and I was looking out the driver's side window. And when it was all over, we looked at each other and there were tears just dripping down our cheeks. And it was really sweet.
Is it a song that if you were to do it today, you would do this new version or the original?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. I do it occasionally. And yes, this new version is stronger. I mean, I really understood her point, and she helped to make it a better song.
Back when you were with Bette, you guys did a lot of different variety of music, girl group music, vintage
sure.
music,
yes.
jazz, swing,
yes.
everything. And it seems to me that you and Bette really were cut from the same cloth, that you had this wide, diverse tapestry that you also, you know, who would think that you're bringing Andrew Sisters songs and making it a hit in the 70s?
That's right. And you know, the kindred spirit part is mm-hmm. that we had a great sense of the history of music, movie music,
right.
Broadway show music, popular music from the 30s, 40s, and 50s and 60s. And when I teach now, and I realize that so many kids that I teach, young adults, have no sense of history, mm-hmm. I have to assign those songs to them so they could at least. And it's really interesting because songs that were written from that golden age usually had long lyrical lines and long melodic lines. And when you have long lines, you breathe differently, because
absolutely.
The sensibility of today's American pop song is very short lines that are repeated and repeated mm-hmm. and repeated. So it's harder to get ideas developed, music or lyrical. And so when kids start to sing these older songs that are magnificent compositions, their whole body changes because they're being asked to bring different things to it. It's just fantastic.
Oh, and you breathe differently, obviously. Yeah. Your diaphragm is used in a different way. And also, you know, it's interesting that we think about storytelling.
Yes.
And, you know, it's something that has gone out of a lot of pop music. And I always think of, I was brought up in the 70s. It was the tail end of the folk scene. And
uh-huh.
I was brought up on Peter, Paul, and Mary and the Weavers, where songs told a story.
Right.
Whether it's a short lyric or a long lyric, there is a through line. And
right.
that's something that is always in your compositions.
Thank you. Well, you know, the songs become monologues.
They do.
And so when I think I'm done with a song, you know, to step back, let it marinate a bit, but to step back and see if the language sounds like it's all coming out of one person's voice. Then you get a sense of, okay, this has settled. This has become a monologue set to music.
How conscious are you of that when you're writing it? Do you think of it during the process, or do you only think of it when you're got a big chunk of it down and say, where did it go?
Well, you know, when you first become a writer, when you first are when it first hits you over the head that songwriting is your other language, it's such a visceral expression to be able to just write ideas and set them to music that I didn't have much discernment because I was just thrilled with the action of doing it. But as I, you know, as the decades pass, I have different tools and I know how to edit as I go. Mm-hmm. And I know it's still a mystery when you get an idea because you still are not sure whether it's the title or something tucked into the second verse and who would be saying this, you know, who would be singing this. But I must say that I edit more as I go now. Also, my sense of harmonics are broader, mm-hmm. and all of that. Yeah.
You know, I try to avoid stories that I've seen people do in many other interviews, but yes. there is a quote of yours that and actually it's a story, but there's one line that everybody needs to hear, which is when you met Bette Midler and you asked her if she was going to have any backup singers.
Oh, yes. That was the night that she and Manilow came to see me at the club. And I had just seen her on the Johnny Carson show and she was just great, brilliant. And so they came to see my set, and when it was over, I went to be introduced to her. And, you know, I said, we're all so excited for you, because we all traveled in packs those days, and we were excited for anybody who was getting ahead in any way. And I asked her, what are you doing next? And she said, well, I'm getting ready for my first Carnegie Hall concert. And I said, wow, are you going to have any background singers? And she said, I don't know. Would you like to sing in back of me? And I thought to myself, well, actually, I'd like to sing instead of you. But in the and that's how I became a founder of the Harlettes.
And I think that you might not have said it to yourself. I think you may have said it to her.
I may have.
I've heard you both tell the story. And what I love about it is there is, you know, you have this confidence about you to actually put yourself out there, which I think so many people today, they're waiting for this opportunity. And I'm like, what are you waiting for?
Exactly.
I mean, the worst they can say is no.
That's right. Yeah. You know, to be preoccupied by I'm not ready or I'm afraid. So do it anyway, even if you're afraid, you know, just see how far you can get.
And we do have a Harlettes photo, and now
yes.
And so, who do we have here? I actually know.
Well, on the my right is Gail Kanter. That is me in the middle. The Toots in the middle, and to the left is Merle Miller. And we were the original Harlettes. We were originally called MGM because those were the initials of our names, and then we were called the Red Light District, and then finally decided on the Harlettes.
Well, it seems like it must have been a really creative time for you guys because not only are you building an act from scratch, but there's also this this stage presence. It is a big show. I mean, there is attitude, there's dialogue.
Right. I mean, all of that is true. It was a huge production and we were learning choreography and all that stuff. But the larger thing within the context of those times is Bette was really the voice of the ostracized gay population.
Right.
You know, being gay in those days was very, very dangerous. And she sang You Gotta Have Friends, and that became the anthem. And they started filling the theaters, and they started filling the arenas. And then other straight folks started filling. And her concerts became a very safe place to feel joy and to share it.
Yeah, what's interesting is you talk about her playing the Continental Baths. And in the beginning, she went to them.
Yes.
And then they followed her. So again, it shows that synergistic relationship. But one of the things that I love, and there's a clip. All right, people, if you're watching this on a replay, you're not going to see the clip because YouTube will take this clip out. But we do have a clip. And it's something that when it showed up on the big screen, it made me smile wildly because I didn't know it was going to happen. Okay. This is a clip from For the Boys.
I can hear a Jenna drum say. When's that kangaroo coming back? When's that kid in the GI lid gonna choo-choo down the track? Poor old me, I'm fizz to be. Every river seems starting to run. Look at these sticks trying to pick out the licks. They're covered with an inch of dust, peep a dust.
What a great, I mean, I didn't know you were going to be in there. And all of a sudden, I'm like, wait a minute, that's Melissa Manchester. How did that come about? Was that Beth's idea? Or?
Yes, it was Beth's idea, and the great Mark Rydell directed it. And it was so much fun. And of course, to sing Hoagy Carmichael's Billy a Dick was just wild. And so it was a lot of fun.
You know, it brings up an interesting point. And I, again, being friends with many harlots, I have found this to be the case, is that each of you are equally adept at singing lead and singing harmonies, which, you know, this sounds like something so simple to a non-musician, but I have met many lead singers who could not sing a third above or below to save their lives. And these are great legendary singers.
Yes,
but
that is
most correct. Most backup singers I know are far more musically adept because they have to be. They have to find their harmonies in a second. And the Pointer Sisters had told me they don't read music, but they can hear those harmonies. What about you? How did harmonies come into your life?
You know, in my family of origin, with my mom and dad and my sister and I, everybody sang. My father was a bassoonist with the Metropolitan Opera, and my mother sang with her sisters during World War II. But anyway, everybody sang when company came, and I was always singing the harmonies.
Really?
Yeah, I did. And the other thing was, from singing jingles, you really learned how to think on your feet. I don't read very quickly, and so, but I can hear, you know, really, really quickly. And so singing harmonies and learning how to take direction as a jingle singer by people who are not terribly articulate in giving direction, you know, it really taught you how to just sort of stay calm and try to understand what they think they want to get from you as a singer. So it was very interesting.
Is it something that you miss when you're singing solo, that you don't get the opportunity to do harmonic work as much?
Well, because I'm singing solo, I'm always singing the lead.
Obviously,
but,
yeah.
But I always create background parts for my other keyboard player and Sue Holder, who also sings on stage with me.
Yes.
So we create a small but mighty sound.
Okay, we are getting good. We're getting late. Okay, I've got photos. I want to ask you about certain people who you've met or worked with.
Yeah.
Stephen Sondheim.
Oh my gosh. Oh my gosh.
I've never heard you talk about him. So
oh
please.
My gosh. Well, I was invited to play Beggar Woman in the 25th anniversary performance out in LA at the Amundsen Theater of Sweeney Todd. And I had the opportunity to sing truncated songs for my character. And then afterwards, I got a chance to meet him. And one of the highlights of my life.
Yeah. Are you attracted to doing musical theater? No, I know that you write,
I've done some musical theater. I did the national tour. I took over for Bernadette Peters in the national tour of Song and Dance.
Which I had no idea until I was preparing for this.
Yeah, and it was very rigorous because in Song and Dance, you are by yourself on stage for act one. So it's a lot of work 8 times a week. And then I did another Andrew Lloyd Webber's Music of the Night, which was more like a review, a big production review. So that was fun. I would like to be on Broadway so that I don't have to travel like I was traveling days. But we shall see.
Is there a role that you would covet?
I don't know. I think I would like to create a role.
Really?
We shall see. But I do love writing for theater. I've written an off-Broadway show called I Sent You a Letter to My Love.
Here it is.
And then I wrote another called that I contributed to called Hats. And then Sweet Potato Queens was the latest one that we have had several productions and two that were supposed to happen last year that had to be postponed.
Of course.
Yeah.
As I mentioned, the tribute album, the lead single was Walk On By. Yes. And it had the distinction, and I was reading reviews as I was preparing for this, that it was received by many people, I don't want to say better than the original, but as its own entity. It wasn't seen as a cover because it was so reinterpreted.
Yes.
And I found this photo of you and Dionne Warwick, and I'm curious, what did Dionne think of it?
Oh, you know, she approved. She's so dear. You Gotta Love the Life, I invited her to sing on a lyric, the last lyric written by Hal David that I set to music, and the fact that she sang on it with me and Joe Sample, it was one of his last performances. It was really great. But for Walk On By, I find that when I can find the inner life of a song and make it and blow it up, it's really interesting what can happen. And Walk On By, I found very dramatic, and I wanted to emphasize that part. And when we did a video of that,
oh, it's such a gorgeous video.
Yes, and boy, I got pushback about that a lot. You know, people, management wanted me to make it a romantic blah blah blah, and I wanted to make it about homelessness, a homeless right. mom and her children, and Walk On By being that. I mean, I find it really interesting to take a phrase and turn the phrase up on its head, you know. Magic.
And again, it also, you know, I don't know how you do it, but it became a Melissa Manchester song.
Thanks.
And you know, again, it sounds so simple, but to a musician, it's a really hard thing to do.
Yeah.
We talked about Barbra Streisand, and there you are. What does Barbra Streisand mean to you?
Well, she was, you know, like Ella and Judy, she was the bearer of new light when she showed up. You know, nobody looked like her and nobody sounded like her. And I remember my parents going down to the village to seeing her at the Bonsoir opening for Benny Goodman. And she was wearing some kind of a nightgown. And they came home and they said, I don't know who she is, but this is unlike anything else. She, you know, she forged her own way. And there was nothing but pushback. And I remember seeing her as Miss Marmalstein in I Can Get It For You Wholesale.
Oh, wow.
And then in Funny Girl. And there was, you know, this voice and this breath just was endless. And the sound was so pure but powerful. I mean, she was just, and she didn't look like anybody. And she looked more like us than, you know, than Connie Stevens. And so it was really thrilling. You could tell that she was a leader from the very beginning.
I know the story behind this picture, but I just need you to tell it because it's the most bizarre photo.
Oh, yes. That was after I finished. Yes, that's me and Betty Davis and my friend Harriet Wasserman. That was at a New Year's Eve party.
It was at your New Year's Eve party.
Yes, at my home. Yes. yes. After I came home from 6 months on the road doing song and dance, we decided to have a black and white party. And you know, we had about 150 people, 200 people in our home. And I was in the backyard talking to somebody. And in those days, my hairdresser was José Hébert, very famous Hollywood guy. Mm-hmm. And somebody called out across the yard to me, Melissa, Betty Davis is here. I said, I don't know a Betty Davis. And he said, oh, not a Betty Davis, the Betty Davis. And José had brought her.
Oh,
and
wow.
She was just fantastic. I mean, she was, you know, maybe 85 pounds soaking wet. And holding court and smoking like a chimney. And then 2 days later, she talked about my party in the valley on the Johnny Carson show.
And we have that clip. So take a look at that.
What'd you do New Year's Eve?
This New Year's Eve?
What'd you do?
This New Year's Eve, I went to an enormous party in the Valley for Melissa, given by Melissa Manchester. Yes, you are looking. It was quite a different experience for me. Yeah, I learned quite a lot about the New World that night. Although I admire her very much.
I admire her very much. Come on.
Aren't I a lucky girl?
You know, you really are. Can I just tell you, you've had, it's an amazing life. I want to talk about what you're doing now, because what I think is so interesting, and you talked about Citrus College, is that you have, again, in the best sense of the word, is that artists learn from each other, and that there is never a teacher and a student without a teacher and a student. And it seems to me, from what I've read, and I've also seen some interviews with the kids who have worked with you, is that you've gotten as much out of this as they have.
Oh, by miles. I mean, you know, when you're teaching, not that it was part of any conscious design on my part, when I was invited to teach either at USC or at Citrus, by teaching, first of all, you realize how much you know because kids ask you, and then you realize how much you have to offer. Because for young people, for young adults, no matter how much they've been through in life, what you learn to be true is that there are portions of their mind that are just empty. So not only are you teaching them, in my case, about songwriting or stage performance, but you're teaching them how to think. You're teaching them how to think. Mm-hmm. And that becomes very interesting. And what I've learned from my students, because they kept coming in to my class with new projects all shiny and wrapped and all that. And I thought, well, maybe everybody is, you know, signing with an independent record label. They walked me into the world of independent artists. And I said, did you sign with an independent label? I mean, how are you getting your music out? And they said, no, we're independent artists and we do crowdfunding. You should do that too. And I said, that's great. What is that? And one of my students came up and explained to my manager and I what it meant. And it's been very interesting to cultivate a village of people who will help support your artistic endeavors.
Yeah, not only that, and I hadn't thought of it this way. You Gotta Love the Life was crowdfunded. It started on Indiegogo.
Yes.
And I thought, and it never occurred to me that in crowdfunding this way, not only are you obviously funding the project, but you're building buzz, you're marketing, you're outreaching, you're social networking, so that when the project actually comes out, there is this built-in audience who maybe didn't know who Melissa Manchester was or that she had something new coming out, but heard of it through a friend who had a friend who donated $20.
Yes, the Fellas was crowdfunded as well. Yes.
The
thing is that the village of your supporters, they just lean in like a village of aunties and uncles. You know, it's not even stalkers. At one point, I had to, you know, post, it's going to take a month longer than I thought to release something. And to a man, they'd say, you just take your time and get it right. We're here for you. And it's just adorable. It was so sweet.
You know, I guess, are you able to contrast that with the studio system where there is a hard deadline, ready or not, it's coming out?
Yes. Listen, the positive about record companies, which barely exist anymore, is that not only were they the bank, they were a big engine. There was a press, there were men mostly on the ground all over the country pushing you. There were people that you met in each city, whether you were doing a primary tour or a secondary market tour or a college tour. There's that. And you know, that's just the reality. And it was magnificent when it worked.
Is it possible to generate that today, or is it even more possible? It just takes more work.
Well, you know, being an independent artist is code word for it takes you four times as much to get anything done, because it's, you know, it's just me and my manager. But nonetheless, everything is so different these days that I don't necessarily have to go on a radio tour to get things placed, because the truth is, I don't presume I'm going to be played on the radio anymore.
Right.
And because I have Facebook platforms and YouTube channels and all that stuff, I'm content at almost 50 years into this career.
Wow.
With getting my music the way I hear it and feel it out at all. So if I write a choral piece and put it out, if I roll out review, you know, a video a month, it's all coming from the same impulse for me to get my work done. And so for that, I'm very grateful.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned the review project, which is, again, of people who missed it earlier, you revisiting your material.
Yes.
It's almost like a tribute CD to you.
I guess so, yes.
And, you know, is there something that was in the shelves that you never sang that you've looked at and said, you know, I wrote this song 40 years ago that I never did anything with? Do you rediscover old compositions?
Yes, there is going to be a song, maybe two, on review of never recorded old brand new songs.
And speaking of old songs, it's a guilty pleasure of mine, I'm sorry, but Thief of Hearts.
Oh.
You did there was during a time where you were doing a lot of songs for movies that ended up on soundtracks.
Yes.
And it was a song that got club play. Was it, did you write that?
I co-wrote it, yeah.
Is it a song that, when you write a song, that's not the question is a song like that written for a movie, or is it something that was in the back and they say, do you have anything that we could use in a movie?
No.
How does it work?
Yeah, that was written for a movie. You know, most movie songs that I've recorded or written for were written for the work. And the latest one that I did several years ago at this point with Mary Steenburgen for a movie called Dirty Girl. And it was just a beautiful experience. So yes, you know, to be inspired by a story that already exists in film form, to hear the music coming out of your brain and the lyric coming out of your brain because you're inspired by this larger story is really fantastic, because you have an assignment, you know, you know what you need to fulfill. Yeah.
And you're not working in a vacuum. You're really being inspired by something. I'm looking. We have so many questions. Oh, my God. Now I have to put the glasses on, Melissa.
Right. And the last and before that, I had written, you know, several projects for Disney. I wrote the score for Lady and the Tramp 2. And
there was another you did. There was something else that you did for Disney, an original
music. The Great Mouse Detective. Yeah.
Yes. Right. Right. I mean, and that's the thing is that, again, you're always doing something.
I like to do stuff.
And I should mention also, you've done a lot of charity. You've done a lot of Seth Rudetsky and James shows, the Concerts for America, I remember vividly.
Yes.
A lot of politically motivated things. You've really gotten involved. You sang at the Women's March in Los Angeles, which was actually bigger than the one in Washington.
Yes, it was 750,000 people.
Unbelievable.
Yes, and I've been singing for AIDS research since 1984.
I'm just looking. I've been a Melissa Manchester fan forever. Look, people adore you. Melissa and her music have been such a bright light in the midst of this uncertainty and craziness. That really has to be a feeling that not only have these people been with you all along, but they're turning to you for comfort.
Yes, it's amazing. Yes, I take it. I don't take it for granted at all.
Oh, Robert L. just said, I'm so glad you two finally connected. I've talked about you on so many shows because every time that you and I were trying to do this a few times, and I had such a crazy schedule right before, and I also wanted to time it with your videos coming out. When Mindy Sterling, such a fan forever, tribute is adorable. deep favorite. Melissa is still one of the greatest shows I've ever seen. And I should point out to people, the voice is as powerful as ever. It really, and again, I also think that if you are a great interpreter, that ages much better than somebody who is purely known for a pretty voice.
Right. You're right. Well, you know, the voice does age, and it widens and deepens, and your wisdom and your life informs how you sing and what you sing. So I think it's fantastic.
And it's richer. I also think there is this resonance that comes through. And yes, it's funny. People talk about Streisand lowering keys.
Sure.
And I'm like, I would rather hear something sung well and interpreted well than hear in my ear she's worried about a note.
Oh, of course.
Well, who's interested in that? Yeah, I'm not interested in that at all. Let's tell people where they can find your music. You have a website, melissamanchester.com.
Yes, indeed. And on Facebook, you can see all of the videos and my choral piece, and on iTunes and on YouTube. So I'm around.
You're everywhere. And so I'm going to end with your revisited version of You Should Hear. And were you always thinking that it was something that was, I kept thinking, Susan, your manager, had talked to me that it was about to come out in conjunction with the inauguration.
Yes.
And I'm like, well, how does this connect with the inauguration? Is Joe hearing about it? But after watching the video, it's a very empowering song.
Thank you. I think so, too. And the she in the title, You Should Hear How She Talks About You. The she, to me, is the nation. And I really like that. I found power in recontextualizing the song. So it wasn't just a romantic boy girl song or whatever. And so it informed the video, and it brought a lot of energy to it, I think.
What I also loved was that in a time where we have a female vice president, mm-hmm. and women really stepping up and probably making this change, making Biden the president, it was women coming to the fore. Yeah. I liked the fact that you're acknowledging the power of women, particularly in this time with the Me Too movement and mm-hmm. all other issues, that we not only are we supporting you, we're talking, we're pushing back.
That's exactly right. And we're voting.
And we're voting, and we're getting people out to vote. I loved that you included Stacey Abrams in there.
Yes,
you know,
yes.
I think I just think that it's so marvelous and sounds just as current as ever.
Thank you. Thanks.
So, Melissa, I want to thank you for being on the show. Finally, we've had you on. You are just a delight. We have so much more that I could have talked about, but I mean, my God, it is, like you said, going on 50 years, this career. So I want to thank you for doing this. We're going to leave people with the song. Check out her website, and you and I will talk soon. We'll have you
back. Stay well.
All right. Thanks. You, Melissa. Bye-bye. And everyone, thanks for watching. This is going to be Melissa Manchester's You Should Hear. If you stay, Melissa, I'll talk to you when I go off the air. Don't forget, everybody, that Tuesday, Mary Wilson tribute with all sorts of people. Next Thursday, Eric Roberts. Check us out. I know I should be always telling you where my website is. Is it here? Well, BillyMasters.com. We are here Tuesdays and Thursdays, 3 p.m. And today, that's it. See, when I don't have my glasses on, I don't know where I am. All of our shows can be found at BillyMasters.com/TV and on our YouTube channel, which is Billy Masters TV. Thank you for watching, people. Stay safe. Be nice to each other. Stop bitching about things, because we're all doing the best we can. At least I hope we are. I will see you next Tuesday. And this is Melissa Manchester. And this was Billy Masters Live. And if we're here, trust me, we're live. Bye, guys.